We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It is now 11:32 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to the Corey Hepler Show. I'm filling in today, Geralyn Steele. And if you like what you hear, join us on Sunday nights from 7 to 11 p.m. Our final guest tonight, or today, I keep saying tonight, my goodness, Alex Del Carmen. We're going to ask the question, what are officers taught when it comes to restraining citizens during an arrest? That's the thing we want to know. What brings them to that point? Well, Alex Del Carmen is the Associate Dean and Professor, School of Criminology, Criminal Justice and Strategic Studies, College of Liberal and Fine Arts, Tarleton State University, and he's a member of the Texas A&M University System. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex Del Carmen. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So many of us want to know what brings an officer to that point where they restrain a citizen like this. How do you answer that?
You know, it's a very difficult question to answer. You know, for 22 years, I've trained thousands of police officers all over the United States. And in Texas, I've trained every chief of police in the area of racial profiling. And I can tell you that what we saw in Minneapolis happen last week is unexplainable, unjustifiable, and it is certainly not something that we teach our police officers to do in the state of Texas.
So then here we are. It goes from state to state. It's different. You know, some restraints are accepted in one state and then it's not accepted in another. Is this something that we need to pass out to residents when they move into a community and tell them, hey, by the way, this is what our police can do to you?
Right. I mean, look, 80% of the agencies, at least 80, perhaps even as high as 90% of the agencies in the United States, out of all, you know, 29,000-30,000 police agencies in the U.S., do not allow for that type of restraint to take place. The United States Department of Justice a few years ago actually came out with a study that suggested that when you put someone on their belly on the ground and you handcuff them, you've got to get them off the ground right away, for there are all these correlations between doing that and the person dying. Right, so even the Justice Department has said not to do it. I think it's irresponsible for people, you know, agencies to still have that particular technique. Officers today have an array of tools that they can use, and obviously it's based on the threat level, right? So if somebody's coming out at you with a bat, then you can use a taser. If somebody's coming out with a gun, then you can certainly use lethal force. But we tell officers that it's progressive, and that we simply try to de-escalate as best as we can whenever they face something like that.
We are not seeing de-escalation. As you might have seen on television yesterday, there was a young college student in a car with his girlfriend, and they stopped the car and began tasing him when they told him to get out. He was trying to take off his seatbelt from what I could see, okay? And they kept tasing him. He almost lost consciousness. I don't understand why they do the force first. Why not ask the question, young man, where are you going? Are you a part of this? Are you getting out of the car? We need you to get out of the streets. You know, you see the people protesting. Why not have the conversation first?
There's no question, right? And typically you would find that police officers that are well-trained would never engage in that type of behavior as the first sort of introductory note to a suspect, right? So at the end of the day, this is essentially bad police work, poorly trained police officers, and quite frankly, and I've said this often now for the past few days, people that should have never been police officers in the first place. I mean, these are individuals. When you look at the case in Minneapolis and what happened to you guys in your great city, and you look at this police officer that has his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for 9 long minutes, and you look at the fact that there are 3 other officers standing by looking elsewhere and ignoring the crime that is taking place in front of them, that is not only unexcusable, but it is an indicator that there are chronic problems in that police department that need to be addressed.
Exactly. And so how do we address them?
But by either a court intervention. I've worked in 2 federal consent decree cases in the United States, currently actually working one of them. And I can tell you right now that if the Justice Department, given the political climate in Washington, does not come in and do a full investigation and put this police department on a consent decree, which is doubtful given the political climate in D.C. I will tell you that the next step after that is to have the attorney general of the state simply, as they did in Illinois, simply look into this and actually file a lawsuit against the police department and agree on some sort of a police reform, which is exactly what happened in Chicago just this past year. And even though DOJ, the Department of Justice, actually opposed it, they are under a police reform case that was initiated by the Illinois Attorney General. I think you all have that option as well.
You know, when I hear investigation, and that's exactly what you're suggesting, is that we, you know, get together with the DOJ and we investigate. We all know the communities have accepted that when you start talking investigation, it's going to take forever. And more than likely, the outcome is not going to be in favor of the person who had to suffer this type of abuse. So if that's the case and it's not working, there has to be another way. Here's a question I have for you, Professor. Is this really based on police officers that are maybe afraid of going into the crowds? Are they afraid for their lives? And that's why they take to this action of restraining, which turns out to be abusive.
You know, I've actually said it in the past, even before the incident with Mr. Floyd, that we have a generation of police officers that are emerging now that are simply afraid to get dirty, right? They're afraid to get in a fist fight. They're afraid to actually use physical force to restrain somebody. So they're going to resort to a weapon. They're going to resort to a taser, which is a cleaner, faster, and less intrusive way in their mind to be able to subdue a suspect, which is exactly the wrong thing to do. And the bottom line is that we need to train officers to think first, to act second, right? Officers are trained to de-escalate. Officers, good police officers, are trained to engage in, they even have a name for it, verbal judo. The idea that you are going to use your words, your command voice, in order to subdue a suspect if need be, not to use a taser or a gun or your knee to kill someone that is asking, for their mom and that is telling you that they cannot breathe for 9 long minutes while the officer just looks onward. I mean, there's no excuse for that. And I will tell you, here in Texas, we've had a lot of police chiefs, a lot of police officers that have forcefully come out against this and said this individual took us back 25 years on community relations.
Okay, then. Is it a question of weaponry? I've actually heard from some people in communities that say, hey, the police are out-weaponed. You know, the communities where, you have gangs and that sort of thing, that they have bigger and better weapons than even our police departments have around the country. Is that a concern?
You know, look, some people have said that, but I think that's a different conversation versus the conversation we're having right now, right? That even if you have access to an AR-15 or to a shotgun as a police officer, the bottom line is that just because you can use it, it doesn't mean that you should use it, right? Just because it's legal, it doesn't mean it's justified and right. And so at the end of the day, police officers, again, are trained on best practices. They're trained to de-escalate, and they are trained to not use that force component unless it is absolutely necessary and required.
At the same time, you know, you start to see what the police officers are driving now, right? You know, some of the cars look like they're souped up, as they used to say in my day, right? Where, you know, they've got the fancy look to the car and it's really shiny and all the blinking lights going all the way down by the tires. I mean, people start to look at that and go, wow, that's really cool. That's not what we're supposed to say. We're supposed to say, hey, that's our neighborhood police officer. Hey, police officer, stay safe tonight. We're praying for you. I don't want to look at the car and go, wow, that's so hip that we have that. But is it necessary for us to have a showing that the police have all the things that they need and that they driving around well, you know, looking good, and they are booted and suited, as we say?
You know, for the past 30 years, if you look at the history of the color of a police car, we have changed them about 3 or 4 times. They must have 3 or 4 coats of paint of a different color now, if the cars have survived that long, right? And one of the things that you see is in the 1980s, we came up with a Say No to Drugs campaign. We painted the cars dark, black. In the 1990s, we wanted to do community policing. So we encouraged police departments to paint it softer colors so that people would see the friendly neighborhood cops show up. And then they reverted back a few years back to the dark color again. Bottom line is this, right? Technology is advancing. Police officers, we should ensure their safety. There are many thousands of good police officers out there that do a good job, and they go out there and risk their lives every day for the rest of us. Let's not lose sight of that. But at the end of the day, right, aside from the technology, aside from the color of the police car, and aside from the color of their uniform, they are part of the community. They are the embodiment of we, the people, the constitutional words that the founding fathers of this country put together to signify that they need to serve the people. They need to address the people's needs of those individuals that actually pay taxes to pay their salaries. And I always remind police officers in their trainings that they belong to the community. They are accountable to the community that they serve, not the other way around.
Well, we sure have a lot of different people coming into the communities that don't belong in those communities, don't live in those communities, and I wish our police officers lived in the communities that they serve. That's the way it was when I was growing up, and it's unfortunate that they don't here in the great state of Minnesota, in many of the communities.
It is, and I think that we have lost our way in some police agencies, and some police departments have looked the other way, and they have been desperate to hire people, you know, for the sake of hiring them. And they have, you know, they have lowered their standards, who they bring into the police force. And like I've always said before, police training is great, but some people are not trainable, right? Some people that you're bringing into the police force don't have the ability of being trained, and they have such deep biases about others that I don't care how many bias classes you put them through, they'll never get it, right? And those people should not be in this profession. They should get out. They should have never applied.
Yet there are police there are police forces that are really low in numbers, and they need people. And so do they start to change their requirements at some point when they're really in need of more officers? Like there are some places, you know, I've lived in California where you might have to have a degree in order to be a police officer. In other communities, maybe you don't. And does that change from time to time?
Absolutely. And that has changed dramatically, right, in the past few years since we had the Ferguson incident, people throughout the United States. I'm an educator. I teach, you know, both at the PhD, master's, and undergraduate level future police officers and some current police officers. And I can tell you, at my university, we've seen a decline of interest of people that want to go into local police departments and be applicants because of all the negative publicity that police agencies have received in the past few years. So police agencies, in turn, have then become very much desperate, some of them. And what they've done is lower their standards. You know, instead of having somebody that maybe had, you know, a certain drug activity or past drug usage in the past few years, now they're allowing other people to come in. And I think that's a big problem. And I think that's a big concern for us going into the next 20 years of policing, that we have individuals that should have never been given the opportunity and the responsibility of being police officers.
And because it's a union, is it difficult for those police forces or the chiefs to be able to get rid of those people, to let go of them easily, or is it difficult?
There's no question, right? So police unions, their instinct is to fight for the rights of the officers. And I don't necessarily oppose the idea that police officers have rights too, because oftentimes they're labeled as you know, how many times have we seen that police chiefs may in fact, across the United States, that is, may in fact take a, you know, a personal dislike of somebody and may want to dismiss that police officer. That's happened. And so police unions are effective in fighting for the justice of that officer. But in some other cases, what they've done is they've actually, you know, allowed for people that shouldn't be on the job to stay on the job. People that have been fired have actually had to be rehired by a court order, and then they turn around and do horrible things to the rest of the community. And then the rest of the police department, the good officers, are oftentimes labeled for something that they're not.
Right. It's a brotherhood. It's like all for one and one for all, right? It appears that way. And that you know, but I'm a union girl too. And so I really hope that things will get better. And I'm hoping that I can be a part of that getting better, as I know you are, sir. Professor Alex Del Carmen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. He's the Associate Dean and Professor, School of Criminology, Criminal Justice and Strategic Studies, College of Liberal and Fine Arts, my goodness, at the Tarleton State University, a member of the Texas A&M University System.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.